Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In Carl Hiaasen's latest novel, Squeeze Me, it's the height of the Palm Beach charity ball season. For every disease or cause, there's a reason for local luminaries to eat, drink, and do dumb stuff. But when Kiki Pugh Fitzsimmons suddenly vanishes during a swank gala and is later found dead in a concrete grave, panic and chaos erupt. In the novel, we meet Angie Armstrong, a wildlife wrangler extraordinaire who arrives at her own conclusions about what's going on after she is summoned to the posh island to deal with a mysterious and impolite influx of huge, hungry pythons. Squeeze Me is Hiaasen's 15th novel for adults. He's also written half a dozen books for kids, including the Newbery Award winner Hoot, and is a longtime columnist for the Miami Herald. It is a great pleasure to welcome Carl Hiaasen to this week's book show. Carl, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Joe. It's great to talk to you again.
It seems to me that it was inevitable that you would eventually get to writing about Palm Beach, especially given the geography now.
Especially with our newest hashtag Florida Man. at Mar-a-Lago. Yeah, I mean, the climate, Florida was weird enough, you know, before a president became an official state resident. But yeah, I think the other two things that are going on, I mean, I always try to locate the book, obviously, somewhere where there's opportunities for satire. I mean, the whole state, of course, is target-rich environment for that. But Palm Beach in particular, in this era that we're living in right now, seemed to me like a great place to do this. And you know, I've always had a thing for snakes. You know, I grew up in South Florida and used to have pet snakes. So there wasn't much to do when I was growing up down. So we always had snakes. And that was pre-pythons. And the pythons have added a whole new ominous element to it. So it seemed like it was time.
So let's get the pythons out of the way, if that is possible.
Please.
But these are, this is a real problem. And in the novel, these are a huge, just mammoth snakes that are in the southern part of the state. And in your
yes.
novel, they are starting to migrate north.
They're starting to migrate in real life. And, you know, I mean, I always tell people who are skeptical, just Google the two words pythons, Florida, and you won't be able to unsee what you see. I mean, they're moving out of the Everglades. They've pretty much eaten their way out of the Everglades. They're still there in great numbers, but they're showing up more and more often in suburbs. And we had just last week, a woman down in South Florida opened up her washing machine, and there was a big one curled around the spinner in the washing machine. I mean, I wish I was making that up. I'm not, because they're just devastating the ecosystem. They're eating all the natural wildlife and moving on to, family pets.
But this is, it's an invasive species, correct?
I mean, very much so. No, there's a bounty on them. The bounty hunters get paid by the foot, and they've caught lots and lots of them, but they're prolific. One female python can lay 90 eggs, and she'll guard those eggs to make sure they hatch, which basically no other giant reptile does. So they don't have a lot of natural enemies, as you can imagine. And it's a daily news story down here. There's a python found somewhere. Somebody, you know, caught a huge one. So, I mean, I like most of the novels, I do feed off the news, and I'm still, you know, sort of got one foot in the newsroom with the column I write. So there's overflow from the real life stuff that fits perfectly into a humorous novel, because all you can do at this point is laugh.
The thing that I love about your novels is, even though these are an invasive species, even though that these are very troublesome throughout the state, two of the characters at least feel bad when they have to take their life.
Yeah, and I have a friend, a real life friend. I've been on a couple of python hunts with him. We haven't found any, but during those nights, and he's like that. He catches them, but he cannot bring himself. You know, you're supposed to euthanize them and turn them over to state authorities and everything. And he brings them in live and turns them over live, because he's a snake guy like me, and he can't bring himself to do it. But he understands the damage they're doing. He just prefers to let someone else do the the dirty work. And it's they're beautiful. They're incredibly beautiful creatures and formidable. I did a photo shoot up in New York with one, a big one, about a 10-footer. And I knew they would have one in Manhattan for the photo shoot. And I knew it would be a show business python. And it was. The thing had been on red carpets with supermodels, had been in television commercials. So it was, it was a big animal, but it was totally cool. I'm sure it had an agent, CAA. I mean, I'm sure this thing was represented.
The photo is great. I'm glad you, I think it's amusing that you looked at its credits. That's good.
Well, people always ask me, is the snake in the picture? Yeah, it was real. And here's the best part, Joe, and I'll do this quick. You know, New York being New York, when I was going upstairs to do the photo shoot, the doorman stops me. He goes, do you know what they got up there? And I said, what? He said, there's a big giant snake, man. There's a big snake they brought up there. And I said, yeah, I asked him to. So I go up and I do the shoot. And the snake's done. His agent's there. They take him down. The doorman stops the guy, the woman who's carrying this enormous freaking snake out, right? Stops her and says, can I get a picture? And he's in his whole doorman's uniform with the cap on and everything. And standing in front of the building with this 10-foot snake drape. It was a beautiful New York moment. I mean, he went from being terrified of the thing to being, hey man, can I get a picture too?
Of this famous snake.
Yeah.
I tend not to talk to authors about reviews, but there was a line in the Washington Post review that I just want to ask you about, because I thought it was funny, and I was wondering what you made of it. They're writing their review of Squeeze Me, and they say that this is evidence that the Trump era is truly Carl Hiaasen's moment. Do you feel that way?
I saw that line. It worries me that it's anyone's moment, to be honest with you. But I think I thought it was ironic in a way, because this is one of the hardest for someone who writes satire and humor. This is one of the most challenging times to do it, because there isn't a day that goes by when there isn't a headline that eclipses or surpasses for absurdity something that you thought would be a great scene in a novel. You know, I mean, that was one of the hardest things about doing this book, was when you're writing a character like the president in the novel, and you're looking for funny scenes, a little extreme, but close enough to Mark to be satirical, that I was going to pick up the paper the next day and he was actually going to do something funnier in the wrong way than what I was shooting for. And I think it's a very tough time to be doing humor, not just for all that's going on, Joe, the horrible situation in Kenosha and the hurricane and obviously COVID. I mean, I think people are dying for a laugh. And they want to laugh, but I think if you're in the business of making them laugh, it's particularly challenging, because what's going on right now in real life is really beyond what, it's way past what a Tom Wolfe novel would be, for instance. I mean, it's just so I don't know that it's my moment. I just, as I said, Florida was an extremely target-rich environment for satire before he showed up.
One of the things that I find so amazing about the book, though, is because this is such ripe ground and so many people, just watch the late night shows and everybody is picking apart everything the president says. And as you say, it's hard to find something, more comical than what's actually happening, unless you're crying, of course. And
unless
yet,
you're crying.
Right. But you do it. So the president in the book is, you go by his Secret Service name, which is Mastodon, which is funny enough, except that you have the president actually asking to go to the National Zoo so he can see one.
Yeah. He thinks they still exist. Yes. The fictional president you're trying to do a character. And this, and everybody who writes satire does it, try a recognizable character, but not the character, because it is supposed to be fiction, and you're going to go places with it. You don't know where it's going to happen, but yeah, he has those moments. He has some problems with spelling. There are similarities, but on my defense, the real life president drinks Diet Coke, and the character in the book gorges himself on Dr. Pepper. So that's a very important literary distinction.
Very change quite a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Carl Hiaasen is our guest. The new book is Squeeze Me, and it is published by Knopf. I'm just always amazed by your beautiful use of profanity. You're just it's majestic, really. It's just it's stunning. And but you have one phrase in here that I circled, and I never try to mark up a book, but my God, the fact that we've had this man as our president for 4 years, and he's been on our radar for far longer than that, and you can write something, and I just. You refer, this is in chapter 10 of the novel, until the president cocked his head, flared his nostrils, and puffed his scrotal cheeks. Well, my God, Carl, that is brilliant.
It's an image, isn't it?
But it is.
It resonates, I have to say. And I don't know. Yeah, part of me wants to try to defend it. But then again, just look at a picture. you have to, like you said, these are times when we all need to laugh. If you mainline the news like I do and you do, this is our business. This is what we live and feed on. It can put you in a dark place pretty quickly. No matter what your politics are, it can send you there pretty quickly. So, your job as a writer, at least the kind of novels I write, is to try to get people to laugh and turn the page at the same time. I mean, we're any novelist who tells you that they're not supposed to be an entertainer is lying. That's what we do. That's what we get paid to do, is want people to read and want people to be engrossed and entertained. And at the same time, if you're writing a contemporary novel, you want them to recognize certain people and places. And, the pythons are real. The island of Palm Beach is real. And I think they're probably not too far from getting there. They're moving north. So it was just sort of a personal fantasy of mine, and that's the selfish part. I get to make it happen.
The names are brilliant. I mentioned Kiki Pugh Fitzsimmons, but let us not forget, please, Faye Alex Riptoad. And they go on, Trip Teeble and the McMarmots. I mean, you have fun with this. Even the Casa Bellicosa, the name of Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah. And, well, Casa Bellicosa seems like it would be a better name. I spent a lot of time worrying about and fretting on the names, because sometimes characters... Then, if you have the right name that fits what you think of the character, it helps you write. Sometimes, I'll get halfway into a book. Sometimes there'll be one character that just isn't, the tone isn't right, that the moves he's making isn't right, it'll occur to me that that's the wrong name for that dude. That's not the. I want the name to stick from the first time you read it on the page, so that you won't forget that character. Even with the minimum of physical description. So if I don't get it right, I go back and I try out different names. But in Palm Beach, it's kind of easy. If I was getting the Shiny Sheet, which is their daily, social newspaper, and I noticed that all of the socialites had three names, and there must be an ordinance or something, a city ordinance. It wasn't just Donna Smith. You always had to have the middle name in there. And I never knew, is that the name of their most recent ex-husband? Is that an old family name? You never know, but there is a rhythm to it. So I wanted that rhythm in the book when you're reading it.
And why they're billionaires or millionaires, right? So it'll also be of the compost and iron ore Riptoads.
Of course. Yes. That's the family money. There's a great deal of family money, generations of family money. So, yeah, I mean, you have to go, you look for the scene. I mean, it's anybody who writes humor, you're looking for the scene, and you're looking, what's funny, just being there is funny sometimes. And you're just keeping your eyes open and watching and eavesdropping like writers do, just to hear it. And then you just run with it. The trick is then you sit down and you try to write it, make it ring.
You have created some wonderfully memorable characters over your career. Angie Armstrong is a great one. Just a terrific.
I fell for her. She's the lead of the book. She's the heroine of the book, and she's in the wildlife removal business, which in Florida is a thing. There's so much interaction with wildlife, and they call and these people come out in a truck and they'll capture them and relocate these critters, and most of the folks in that business are males. And I thought it would be interesting to have a woman who did it, and kind of a petite woman who did it, because it's an athletic endeavor trying to take a bobcat out of somebody's den. I started that book with the character, excuse me, when I started writing it, that character was a guy. And I got, I don't know, Joe, maybe 50, 75 pages in. And I thought, God, this would be much more fun if this was a woman. And then, of course, I get attached to them very much. I like the female characters very much. And she just got more and more interesting and more fun. And she was smarter than just about any male character in the book, which I find to be also true in real life.
There are so many passages in this book that I just love. I want to get back to the writing of the humor, though, of what goes into a particular line. I know it's not always good to try to dissect humor, but you have one of the characters who's talking about somebody who is one of the group of women who are very pro the president, the
Potusis. Well, fangirls.
Yes, yeah. the fangirls, that one says that it should go right from the booking desk to the death chamber. And you write, "Do not pass go," erupted Deirdre Cobo Lancome. "It was a quip favored by one of her late husbands who'd heard it from a squash partner who worked as a human resources specialist laying off middle-aged executives." That is so full.
Well,
of commentary. It is beautiful.
It is. Yes, it's therapeutic to write that when you see it happening in real life. I mean, how do you write, you can write about it with pathos, and God knows this whole country with whatever, we're close to 40 million people out of jobs or temporarily out of work, at least right now, that they're suffering. But there are people in charge of advancing that suffering. And so you get in a lick whenever you can, if in a book like this, all, you know, just a line. And, you know, I do some inside jokes, I guess I'm writing, because I have friends of mine that will call me and there'll be one line that they'll say that they remind me of a conversation I had with them about something or somebody did something, and you file it away and you slip it in there. And all of a sudden you realize that, you know, that's what writers do. You save every little morsel that you sort of encounter, and you hope that you can, you know, use it to effect when you sit down and actually start the book. And yeah, I know that line.
But that's crafted. That doesn't, I assume that's just not on first draft, that you work on that line.
You know what I do work on, Joe, is, yes, I mean, I'll add things. I'll take out a lot of stuff too, but I work on timing a lot. I work on how it not just looks on the page, but how it strikes your ear. Although I don't read it aloud or anything, and I don't do the audio books, but I think there's a comic timing, and also there's a deadpan nature to it, where you want it to be subtle. One of the great things about my readers over the years, and this is why I feel so lucky, is that they get it. You know, I mean, they get the joke, and they laugh for the right reason. I don't know if you can get where I'm coming from.
Absolutely.
But they're really smart. I mean, I could, as I did when I was young, write a book about corruption and murder on the professional bass fishing circuit. And most of my readers are not bass fishermen, but they got it. They dug it, you know, and because it was sort of metaphorical for a lot of other corruption and stuff that was going on. But not every writer is going to venture into territory like that. I mean, I pretty much had that whole genre to myself. I don't think there was I don't think John Updike wrote one single bass fishing novel. I'm pretty sure
no,
he didn't.
Not that I'm aware of, anyway. No.
Yeah.
And so even when you have something like Casa Bellicosa, that where the house band is the collusionists, I mean, that's just perfect. But that goes back to what I was saying before, is that a lot of this has been mined for humor, but man, it's still, you have found something original and fresh in it.
Well, thank you. I mean, here's the deal. I redo and rewrite all up until the time I finally say goodbye to the manuscript. I'm always tinkering. And I think if you talk to a lot of writers, they'll admit they sort of wake up in the middle of the night worrying about an adjective or a line. Is that working? Is the line working or is it not? And I've talked to Dave Barry about this a lot, because he and I both get asked, do you laugh out loud while you're writing this stuff? Then we laugh and we talk about it, because we say, It's the most dead serious. We both look grim when we're writing this. There's no laugh allowed. You come out of the office looking like you just went to a funeral, because humor is tricky, and there one word can be off in a sentence or a passage or a piece of dialogue. One little word can be wrong, and it doesn't work. So, yeah, it's misery, actually.
Dave Barry once told me that he worried because if you go after it enough, it starts to not become funny.
That's the danger. If you read something 80 times, you know, as you do when you're writing, you're going back and looking at that chapter, this chapter, it starts to feel flat to you. You wonder if it's funny. And I don't let anyone look at the stuff. I mean, my editor will get, you know, a bunch of chapters, my agent, but I don't pass it around to my friends or people in my family and say, hey, does this seem funny to you? Is this, I completely sort of rely on instinct. But yeah, there's a point after you've looked at a manuscript, you know, for a year and gone over every line, comma, semicolon, everything, every bit of dialogue, where you start to wonder, I thought that was brilliant when I wrote it, and I wonder if it sucks. And I think that's natural. It just comes from, you know, it's one thing to write the column. You write a newspaper column, bang, and it's in the paper, bing. And you don't have time to agonize about or rewrite. I mean, it's just it. But with a book that you live with, it's like this is a whole new set of characters. They're become part of your life. There's a bit of a grind because you want everything to be perfect. You just tend to agonize too much. And so when people read it and they give you this terrific feedback, you think to yourself, okay, I had it right the first time I wrote it. It was pretty good. I'm glad I left it in.
Mm. The book is dedicated to your brother, Rob. Rob,
yes,
was tragically one of the five journalists killed in a mass shooting in Annapolis, Maryland, 2 years ago at the Capital Gazette.
Right.
Were you writing the book during this time of?
There was just a lot going on in my life for the last couple of years. And of course, when Rob was murdered, I actually went for a couple of months where I couldn't even write a column. And I've been doing it a long time, but I don't want to say paralyzed, but I was in such a state of shock and grief. So I thought about it and I thought, God, he would not want me to stop. My brother was a marvelous writer and a very gifted guy, excuse me. And his sense of humor was amazing. And I thought the one thing he wouldn't have wanted me to do, A, is get back into the column as quick as you can. And B, keep writing the books, even though it's very, very difficult to be funny when that shakes up your world and his wife and his kids and just the whole scene. I mean, it's very, very hard to go into a room by yourself and write something funny. But I felt he would have wanted me to do it. I mean, he was one of my biggest fans, and I always knew if I could get him to laugh that I'd written a good line. I would be okay. So that was, I was just determined to do this book because I just knew he would have wanted me to.
You write at the end of the book in the acknowledgments, you mention your editor, the great Sonny Mehta, who was such a force. And you say in that it was someone who you write, he was also a good friend in difficult times. I assume this was one of the difficult times.
Yes, Sonny was wonderful. After Rob died, and you know, struggling, and he just said, "Don't worry about the deadline. You know, this book will come to you, and it'll be great." And so he'd been, you know, when I started it, we were working together, and you know, emailing notes back. I would send Sonny five or six at a time, and never tell him what the book was about until he got the first five, and that's how we worked. And then he got sick, it was December 2019, and then he passed away. And I, you know, he'd been my editor for, my gosh, I guess 29 years, I want to say, I think, Joe. I mean, and he was one of the iconic editors in New York publishing. And
yeah.
A lot of Nobel Prize, Pulitzer Prize, way more distinguished roster than I deserve to be on. And I was always, I never took it for granted that he had somehow wanted to edit my stuff personally, because he didn't do that much. It wasn't a lot of editors towards the end that he had his hands on with. So I always felt lucky that I got the time with him.
You were talking about taking a break, but it was a few months before you wrote a column after your brother's murder.
Yeah, it was a couple months. And then they were great at the Miami Herald about it. They understood, and Rob had lots of friends there, and at the Palm Beach Post, the Baltimore Sun, all those places. And yeah, and they were good. And so I had to come back, and the first one was about him, and then you move on, you know. But there was so many ironies, Joe, because I had written for so many years about the absurd political power claimed by the NRA in loosening some of these laws, so that really basically any nut who wants a gun can get a gun in this country. It's not hard to do at all, and creating that situation. And I had friends of mine. I was a gun owner, and I had friends of mine who are gun owners and hunters that were just appalled by some of the mutants and misfits who are walking around with serious weapons. And you know, I've been writing in this column about it a long time, and then to have a mass shooting like that affect me personally and my family, and certainly Rob's family, was, and I wrote at the time, he would not want it to be singled out as there are so many victims, and this happens so often in this country, and the community of survivors, of family members who have been damaged by mass shootings, is now so large. And my family and Rob's family just became a part of that community. It was just, it's just one more name that goes up on the list of people who, you know. And the irony too, Joe, is, you know, Rob and I both went to high school about 10 miles from Parkland. Even though we covered this stuff as journalists, it was hitting very close to home because of that's where we grew up down there. I will say this. I do think he would have liked the book, because he did have a terrific sense of humor. He was just, a really gifted guy, and we all miss him every day.
Again, Carl Hiaasen's latest is Squeeze Me, a novel. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.